You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to the show. My name's Stu Goldsmith. Today I am speaking to the wonderful Eddie Pepitone, who returns live to the show in this episode recorded at South by Southwest, which you'll hear us struggle to remember exactly when it was, but I think Eddie was something like episode 20? Well, he was certainly in the first 20 episodes. I think he was in the first live run of episodes initially when we were recording them at the Gilded Balloon at the Edinburgh Festival many, many years ago. So it was wonderful to welcome him back onto the show, and thank you very much to everyone at South by Southwest who looked after us at the Creek and the Cave, which is a lovely little venue in Austin, Texas. I'm pretty sure I begin this interview by just fawning over him, particularly with reference to For the Masses, which is his new comedy special released by 800 Pound Gorilla and currently available for free on YouTube. And it's significant of the way things work now in comedy, in that a special which is... a comedian who I won't name because it was a private message said that they'd watched it 5 times and it's a masterpiece. And I cannot disagree with that. I've listened to it about 2.5 times. I cannot recommend it enough. And I think it's a sign of the times that stuff like that is now released for free online rather than... if it doesn't make it to one of the big platforms, then it's not like people buy DVDs anymore. So why should it be a surprise, really, that something so good be available free? But it's still, you watch it and you go, oh my God, why aren't I paying for this? So please do check out For the Masses, as well as Eddie Pepitone's new excellent podcast, Apocalypse Soon, which I listened to, a very funny episode with guest Andy Kindler, friend of the pod. No more to say, really, about this one. It's quintessential Pepitone. We're going to talk about the special in detail, how he structured and taped it, why all of his sets are cries for help, and his vulnerabilities and internal responses to things. And also, we touched briefly on how to destroy him if you were to be a heckler at one of his gigs. But I ask you to use that information responsibly. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for ad-free episodes, extra content from every show that has it, and much more by way of supporting the podcast. But without further ado, this is Eddie Pepitone returning. Thanks for coming on the show, Eddie. It's been 8 years since your last appearance. This is the longest gap of any guest.
Well, I don't want to overexpose myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I usually do podcast appearances every 8 years.
I see.
Yeah.
I can't believe that didn't get a laugh. I enjoyed it a lot.
No, it's not going to be easy, I could tell.
I think I've...
It's sort of like, this is sort of the time of day. It's light out. This is like being, I feel like this is like a talk, a book. I feel like it's a book thing.
Yes.
Like I wrote a book.
Sure.
About nuclear devastation. Could be, though, right?
It's my fault. I primed them for the fact that it wasn't funny, and now they will go, we'll make sure not to laugh. What I meant was, it's not intended to be funny. If it turns out to be funny, that's good.
Okay. Well, thank you for telling me that, because...
Well, it was only 8 years ago. I thought you'd remember.
No. Because I'm always trying to be funny, Always. I really am. Even with my shrink. Like,
yes.
we're doing inner child work now, trauma work, and I still managed to get in some great one-liners. Turns out I was traumatized, but there's a lot of fodder there.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a traumatized person.
I want to get into the drama.
This is not going well, and I apologize.
No, no, this is great. We're going to get in.
I'm trying to be too funny. I'm going to be serious now. Go ahead.
We're gonna get into the trauma. We're very happy to talk about the trauma.
What is your name, kid?
This is so good. I think you really suit a cigar. You called that a stogie earlier on. Is that a particular type of cigar? Is that just?
Oh, I don't know. My friend just gave it to me backstage. I like smoking cigars occasionally, about once every 8 years. That'd be funny. I do things just once every 8 years.
I want to start by talking about your special for the masses, which is, I don't use this word lightly, a masterpiece. It's absolutely incredible.
Now, that should get like applause. Yeah.
Yeah.
As soon as he mentioned it, there should have been applause, which tells me a lot of you, or at least half of you, don't really know me or that special, which is disappointing. It's basically you're just kind of hanging out. Like, you're like, let's wander in here. All right. But yes, thank you, Stuart. I'm going to stop. All right? No more jokes for you people. Go ahead.
It's so good. It's so good.
Thank
you. Feel like, does it feel like a kind of a crescendo? Does it feel like a...
What are you saying?
Oh,
like,
no,
that's
I don't...
it?
Hey, it's good enough. If that was your last thing,
I know,
that would be good enough.
I know. I really kind of feel that way.
That's what I meant. It's like, does it feel like a significant step up from previous work? All of which I loved. I'm a big fan of yours, as you know.
Yeah.
But this is, it's so good. I was listening to it again this morning, and I felt like it's almost just one tag. Everything is a tag. You walk on, without even really telling a joke, you just walk on, you're you, the beginning stuff about, like, I'm on Marley. You're just you, and then everything is a tag. Tag, 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 tag. It's like there's no segues. The structure
really
is just invisible. You're just funny. It's fucking incredible, Eddie. I think it's incredible. Deal with that.
I don't know how that happened, you know, and it's really weird doing a special because it's like you're leading up to it, right? And the way I work is I am all over the place. Like, I am not a structured person at all. You know, I just kind of improvise a lot. I have like bullet point ideas. I love to go up with an idea and then play around within that idea. I'm not a one-liner. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is my writing process is kind of like, I always tell people that I write on stage, mm-hmm. you know? So to put a special together for someone like me is like kind of like a collage, like having all these colors on an easel, you know, and being like, okay, I'll put that here. And I had a lot of help. The guy who directs it for me, he's great. His name is Stephen Fine Arts, and he directed The Bitter Buddha, which was him approaching me and saying, I want to do a documentary on you, after he saw me on Marin's podcast. Mm-hmm. What the fuck? And he's been like a confidant since then. He filmed my first special, which is called In Ruins, and with this one, I tape all of my sets on my iPhone, and he said, just give me all of your fucking tapes, and I just, like, I perform a lot, you know, in LA, around the country, and he took them all, and he hired another guy, and they went through them and just wrote. They had a big big cork board, and they put index cards like this bit, this bit.
Okay,
this bit.
They wrote the script for you from the stuff that you'd said. They kind of collaged.
They just wrote all the bits that they thought
that's
were
amazing.
Real good, and it just helped really focus me, you know. So that really helped me. And. And then I ran – because I just like – as a matter of fact, the next special idea I have, me and him were talking, was we rent out a theater for 3 nights and I just improvise. Yeah. I just do what I've been doing, you know, lately. Just – and he takes the best of the 3 nights – and puts that,
yeah,
you know, in a special.
Because I was going to ask, the actual, like, did you shoot it twice? And did you do it in the same order each time? Because I guess, the sense I get is that you're, like, if you're, you know, if you're headlining at a club, a comic might go, I haven't really worked out the set. A comic that does the sort of material you do, you might go, I'll probably open with that, I'll probably close with that. And then the other things will be from my back catalogue or my, you know, my walking around gear, but I don't know what order, I don't know what will happen. And I wondered whether it felt like an imposition for you to have to repeat the same thing exactly, if in fact you did that.
Yeah, no, I didn't. But the first show, I was very, like, I had the set list.
Yeah.
And I made sure to hit it pretty much, even though there was a lot of improv and a lot of good lines came at, because the audience, not like they were so with me.
Yeah.
You know, an opposite type situation than this right now. Like, they were hanging on every fucking word. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
I just
felt
incredible love, you know? Whereas here, I feel like it's a first date. You know what I mean? Oh, is that what you do for a living? Really? You're on antidepressants. Okay. Do you get erections?
Let's talk about your relationship to your crowd in that special, with specific regard to that special, because one of the things you do so well is you, like you said, the first special was called In Ruins. I know your podcast, your new podcast is called Apocalypse Soon. Like, you're like, you're kind of, it's kind of naked and howling before the void. That's how I see your work, right? Would you think that's fair? Like, your relationship to an audience, like, you
naked
are
naked and howling before the void. That could be the title of my next one. You know? And I'm just, like, naked behind a grand piano. And I'm looking demure and come hither.
Yeah.
But there's a void. Anyway, we'll work it out.
But I just wonder about your, like, the approach in that special is very specifically, like, there are a few beats, there's moments throughout the special where you say things like, this is brilliant and you don't deserve it. You know, like you take that angle with the audience, which I
love. Yeah, like I'm doing now. Like, yeah, because I don't really mean it, you know, when I say I don't like you. You know what I mean? Like, I just find that's a funny thing. Like, I love, like, because I think people know I'm fucking kidding. Like, I always say that what I've done lately is I always tape my sets, like I said. So I'll, at some point during the set, I'll look and see how many minutes have gone by.
Yeah.
And I'll go to the audience. I'll go, I've done 10 minutes and it was easy. I don't respect you people. I expected more pushback from people at South by Southwest, like I said last night. And they, I don't know, they just know it's so ridiculous. Yeah.
But that's it. Like, there's that section where in the show where you're talking about your refusal to live the kind of life that you people live, and you're talking about, like, you in your cubicles looking at your photos everywhere of one holiday you went
on
in Hawaii.
I love doing that.
God, it's so good. It's so good.
I love saying, I'm not like you people. I'm an artist. I stay home and feel things all day while you're fucking, I don't know what you do. You ride your bike. You take pictures. But I mean, that's so patently absurd. I just love saying that.
Talk to me about the evolution of that. Relationship with an audience. Like, did you come out swinging when you first started stand-up?
No.
Were you like, and tell me about how that grew, because one of the things I love about the special is it's such a rich character. Do you know what I mean? It's such depth to your relationship with us.
Yeah,
I'm just going to love bomb you for an hour and a half. That's okay. I just think it's incredible.
No, don't do that. But no, I think, you know, when I first started, like I think most comics, I was so fucking so nervous and insecure. And I mean, really, I would throw up backstage occasionally, you know, in a bathroom, not backstage. You know, I would have to, I'd go to a bathroom and I would throw up and I'd be like, because of nerves. And I'd be like, why the fuck are you doing this? I would say to myself. And there was just no choice for me as far as what I do, you know, because I had to do comedy. It's so, it's funny to me when younger comics to me, they approach me and they say, do you have any tips to be a stand-up? And I say, it helps if you're mentally ill. Really helps. You know, there's no, like, you know, there's no playbook really, except to get up and perform. And I think the people who make it have a real need for it. I don't think they're like planning out their lives going, all right. There are some comics who are like this, I think, but like, all right, my first 5 years, I am going to get, you know, on the whatever show, James Corden, which is probably a bad thing. I don't like him for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't like him. I don't like Fallon. I don't like...
Hey, here's a bit.
I don't like them all.
You can list all of the people you dislike, and we'll tell by applause the extent to which the audience agrees.
I used to like Colbert, and I think he's a complete little fucking corporate sellout now. Really. He used to be great. And now he's like just licking the balls of CBS. And they're corporate, you know. It's hard. I guess once you get really successful and you have all this corporate, you know, people depending on you, you can't, I don't know, tell them, you know, what they really are.
Let's just bring it back to that relationship with the audience and the evolution of that. Like,
yeah.
When did you
so
first?
Fear. I was so fucking afraid of the audience that I couldn't look at people. Like, I can look at people now. I would look into the audience, but I would make sure I was looking over their head so I didn't see their eyes, because I was frightened of people, you know, because I had that need so much to be accepted and, you know, just accepted and loved by the audience that I couldn't be myself for you know, the first, like, I don't know, 7 years, 8 years. I just had trouble, man.
Do you remember what changed? Was there like a particular event or a gig or a moment when you
know
started
what? This is going
to
be interesting, especially with you, is that Edinburgh in 2012, that was such, for me, walking through fire. If nobody knows what that festival is, it is insane. You do 29 hour long shows in 30 days. And, you know, it was my first time in Europe. So that was a big deal for me, like traveling into another continent. And I was doing my show in a bar called Tron, which is in the basement. And, you know, people in Scotland and the Edinburgh Festival, people are Olympic drinkers. They fucking – I would walk down the street and they would just be – I called them the singing and weaving people. They'd be singing and weaving down the streets. And, man, I remember – and there was no green room in this. It was a stone cellar. Doug Stanhope did his only Edinburgh show there as well. And it was this stone basement of a former church that was now like a three-level bar. And I'd be sitting on those stone stairs waiting to go on. And you get no warm-up guy, no MC. You just get, ladies and gentlemen. This is what they sounded like to me. Ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome Eddie Pepitone. And I'd be like, and you know, I went through that experience, and I feel like I came out fearless from 29 shows in a different, you know, place. You know, I just went through so much turmoil inside that when I came back, I was like, oh, I can get get through anything, because the fear is always, any fear we have is always a fear of death. You know, it's always annihilation, you know.
You mean actual death as opposed to comedy death? Like real death?
Real death, yes. I think, you know. I mean, that's what I mean. No, real it really is. It's like you just feel like I felt like I was going to die on those steps. You know what I mean? And I remember having a comedy guy who was a mentor way early on. He says, "What's the worst that's going to happen to you on stage? Are they going to tie you down and kill you?" And I would say, yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds about right. So,
and it really sounds like you were, it's certainly in that experience, you really have to put yourself through something. Like, it really costs you. And I think I think that's part of the joy of watching your act, is we can see that it kind of, like, it's one of those acts where you're one of those comics where we sort of see someone kind of ritually disemboweling themselves for us. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is costing this guy something. This is,
Yeah. Well, for me, it's cathartic to be on stage. And another line I say is, folks, my set does not have my performance does not have jokes. My sets are a cry for help. And I say that to the crowd, and they kind of react like you guys just did. But yeah, I always feel like I'm working something out on stage, and I always want to feel comfortable enough with the audience that I feel like I can, like, really open myself up, literally open myself up to the audience and not have to hide behind, you know, this bit. Because I think a lot of comics do that. They hide behind, I'll do this bit about raisins to open, and then I'll do this bit about cheese, you know. I don't know why those topics... I don't know why those topics are coming into my head, but like...
You mean trivial, relatable observations?
Yeah, and what I mean by hiding behind bits is that when you have bits that are really worked out, you could kind of do them just by muscle memory.
Yes, yeah.
You know what I mean? And believe me, I have those bits in my back pocket in case the audience isn't, you know, with me or something, and I'll just say, all right, this is going to be a bit of a slog.
Yeah.
So let me just, you know, try to be funny instead of...
What's your go-to bit if it's a slog? What's your go-to raisins bit?
I have this line now that always gets a tepid response where I go, it's getting so tough out there, folks. People are starting to live in their motorcycles. And it always gets like... But I keep doing it because...
That's a great line.
I think so, too. You know, because I live in L.A. where there are so many homeless people. Yeah. You know, you live in Bristol in England, yeah?
Yeah.
You don't know the pain we have here. In L.A., it's just like a carnival of despair.
Yeah, there's
on one bit of hand, and then the other people are in the hills fucking androids. With the best wines and marijuana. And then down below, it's like just like, you know, people knifing each other.
So this is Eddie. No extras on this one. I left the whole thing in. We didn't record for too long, and I wanted to just leave it all in there for you. It's just wonderful. We will talk more about impending doom and how much truth there is in the backstory of his kind of archetypal persona. I think I used that word correctly in context. And there will be plenty more of this coming at you soon. Now go to YouTube and find Eddie's special For the Masses. If you haven't already watched it or listened to it yet, please, please do that. It's just like from literally, I think the first three words I was howling. Three words! It's just so, it's all just so kind of, he just embodies the howling, the struggle. It's just wonderful. So please do check that out and follow him on Twitter as well, at Eddie Peppertone. I imagine he's on Instagram as well, but, you know, and everything. Basically, put his name into a search engine and connect it to the relevant social. Check out his site, check out his podcast Apocalypse Soon. It's very, very funny and available wherever podcasts are sniffed out. That's that. It's not that. That's all I've got to tell. It's not all I've got to tell you. Listen, this is the thing. I'm going to Edinburgh. It's official. It's on sale. It's on. It's been released now. I'm at the Monkey Barrel at 1:25 p.m. From the 4th to the 11th of August. I cannot wait. The show is called A Shared Illusion. It has the best poster image I've ever had, which I meant to be the image for the 2020 show that never was. It suits this perfectly. It's a work in progress, and it is going to be tremendously fun. Whilst I'm touting things, there's a mail shot coming at you, hopefully next Monday, which will, if you're on the mailing list, which you can join at comedianscomedian.com or stuartgoldsmith.com if you're so inclined, then get on the mailing list and I will keep you abreast of a small, it is not a tour, but a series of work in progress shows, basically previews towards Edinburgh, but it has a sort of Tory vibe, but is no, not a Tory vibe, Jesus, a tour-ish vibe, but is not by any means a tour. And while I'm plugging things, if you're in Bristol or if you're near Bristol or if you can be bothered to travel to near Bristol and then go to Bristol, please come along to Chops Comedy on a Tuesday night, every Tuesday at Friendly Records in North Street in Bedminster. We had a wonderful time last night. Finn Taylor was our headliner and just destroyed the place with his... And I think he's doing... What's he doing? I think he's doing the final week of Edinburgh. I will... He's doing a work in progress in Edinburgh in the last week. I will, in due course, once I know what's going on, send you details or somehow communicate to you all of the things I particularly am excited about and recommend. Plus, I will ask for your recommendations for people who've got Edinburgh shows who should have been on the pod by now and haven't been. We'll do all of that in good time. Yes, so going back to Chops, you can go to chopscomedy.com, which I think just sends you to a Facebook link. Sorry, but there it is. It's just great. And I just did that lovely thing of going on stage. I always am backstage going, I've got nothing. And it forces me to work. And so whether or not you come to Chops, if you are a comic, get a regular new material gig, because it is proving... I mean, I'm not really firing on all cylinders yet. That sort of happens over the next month as I go into the Not A Tour. But... it has absolutely kept me alive creatively and focused when all I've been doing... Like, I haven't been doing that many gigs recently. So just to check in with a new material thing where you panic and absolutely soil yourself and then go on and, in most cases, do very well, or certainly well enough that you go, yeah, there's stuff in that. Maybe I haven't got nothing after all. Maybe there is something. But from that to the possibility of not only nothing, but the end times. Let's get back to Eddie Pepitone.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What's the bit that if we see you and right. you pull out this bit, we as listeners to this show will know Eddie's decided he's in trouble and he's got to pull out an emergency bit? This is a small coterie of insiders who will
right,
be able
right,
to spot that moment.
Right, no, there should be a benefit to coming to this show. You know,
this is
you guys are giving up a perfectly beautiful day outside.
I think this. I'm already enjoying. But before we've even got to the answer, and I hope we do get to an answer. But the idea that this show has become a sort of the weakness is now interactive. I think that's really great. The interactive vulnerability on the Comedians Comedian podcast. Which bit?
Well, here's
we
a line that I here's one where. And by the way, I will also occasionally, you know, sprinkle my set, of course, with this stuff. But if I, you know, I'll say I'm on 200 milligrams of Zoloft daily, and it does nothing for me. I just like the taste. And if that doesn't get anything,
yeah,
you know, I know that, okay, I don't like them. Like, what'll happen?
Yeah, for sure.
That is a bad thing. Like, I immediately, if people don't get stuff that I think is funny,
yeah,
like, if there's an audience, and I'll just be like, I have to really watch it, because I'll be like, part of me will be like, fuck these fucks.
Yeah.
You know? Fuck them, you know?
And then, is there a particular reaction on their part that triggers that? Like my one, I was thinking about this on an episode recently. My own kind of kryptonite is if someone ever, if I've been heckled, I've dealt with the heckler, and their response to being dealt with is to go carry on like that. I just see red. All my comic sensibilities leave me, and I just, you know what I mean. I've lost my temper. I lose it. Like, what's the thing that this is more interactive weakness? How can we destroy an Eddie Pepitone gig? What are you uniquely vulnerable to on stage, Eddie? What's the thing?
Well, you know, I've learned though that you can't really be angry at an audience, because that is just surefire failure. I mean, I could do the mock anger thing, you know, like I don't respect you, you know, but I cannot really be angry for long anyway, you know, because people fucking know that, you know, they know that this guy is just fucking angry, you know, and they sort of feel like you're their dad. I had a bad set at the Comedy Store in LA recently where a woman came up to me and said, I felt like you were my father yelling at me. And I was like, thank you. You always have to be graceful. I was like, thank you very much.
That's what I was going for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I was still pissed off about that set. Yeah.
So do you have like... do you have kind of like a roadmap out of there? If you feel like when you're having a bad gig, do you have like a mental? Have you got any sort of things you can tell you? Any kind of internal mantras?
Yeah, there is. Like here's a bit. Here's a bit, and this is kind of getting back to the previous question too. When I start, one of my favorite bits to do, and I've been doing it for a long time, is I start going, "Is it incredible how they market wine?" Like like everything's a gourmet product these days, and they'll be like, oh, this wine has a playful finish. And if you're ever at a dinner party and you hear a friend say that, tell them they have to work in a prison because they're not tethered to reality. And it's going well. And I have this whole segment of wine material that I've done for years, and it never gets old because the wine insanity keeps growing.
Yeah, okay.
And like the wine industry has somehow convinced people they're not alcoholics, they're gourmets. They just have good taste. You know, if they wind up fucking strangers, it has nothing to do with our bold, vivacious Chardonnay. But I'll go into wine material.
So that's the kind of the material response. Is there like, in terms of your internal thought processes, like I suppose I've only very recently, or like the last 5 years, have I learnt to, and this was pre-pandemic, so I don't even know if I've got this back yet. This is one of the areas in which I'm still rusty after like no live work for a long time. I got to a stage where I kind of lost the bad habit. I kind of rotated out of the bad habit of referring to a bit that hadn't gone as well as I wanted it to, and then that mentally kind of, I'd internally go, oh, God, I shouldn't have said that and stuff. And I got it. You know what I mean? Like I was able to kind of have a map, have a path out of there. It, not in the things I was saying to the audience, but in terms of just kind of thinking, just don't mention it. Just behave as if it's going well. Do you know what I mean? Like, have you got any?
Well,
kind of,
I think that,
like, strategies.
I think the way to get out of stuff is, is to be truthful. Instead of like ignoring the fact that people aren't laughing, you go, holy shit. Like, you go to the audience, like I kind of did up top here. I was like, holy shit, is this going to be like a bad first date? Yeah. Like, to really, like, let the audience know that you know you're not doing that well. And, like, people usually find that funny.
Yeah.
People are like, ah. Oh. He knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember someone called me Bald, like, hey, Baldy, like, out of the blue. Is that a shitty club in L.A. called the Laugh Factory? It's like a shitty fucking club of idiots. You know, the audience, like Comedy Store, if you know L.A. a little bit, the comedy scene, Comedy Store is great. The improv is good. And then the Laugh Factory is just horrific for me, like guys like me, intelligent guys. There's a lot of comics who do okay there, and I don't respect them. You know, because I go there trying to talk about our dissolution. I like talking about our dissolution, even on a Saturday evening, and there's, you know, they're out for dates. You know, people are out for dates on a Saturday night, and I'll go, hey, guy, they're young, and I'll go, hey, I'm sorry you don't have a future. And there'll be enough people in the Comedy Store who get that. Yeah. Instead of the idiots who are like, what the fuck? And they don't know what I'm talking about, you know. And I'll start making fun of people who are still having children these days. Fucking nuts. It's nuts to have kids.
Let's talk about the apocalypse, because I know it's a... Or dissolution. I think dissolution is a really...
Yeah.
That's a really nuanced way of looking at it, because, like, you've been talking about the end of the world for the 20 years or so I've been following your career.
Yes. And I was ahead.
You were ahead.
I was ahead of the curve.
And now I know that, I mean, a show I'm writing, I'm grappling with, I had children, and I'm thinking, well, I think I
oh,
got
I'm
in...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think I... The thought I can't get out of my head is I think I got in under the wire, like... They'll probably
maybe,
be okay, but I don't think they should have kids, which is a horrible thing.
No, they'll be fleeing. They'll be fleeing something. I'm not sure what it's going to be. Eco collapse. Fascism is going.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In Europe.
And the States.
What?
And the States. Fascism is going back in Europe. I mean, the States, right?
And the States, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We're this is just a house of cards here. Any fucking moment, this could be the last show. That's not done under duress. You never know. It's fucking nuts out here in the United States. It's crazy.
How do you like? Let's just explore for a little bit your relationship to the apocalypse and to talking about it and how to like how.
Good
to-
evening, apocalypse. How are you this evening? We have a pretty good relationship. You want to fuck?
Eddie Pepitone, fucking the apocalypse. Flirting with disaster. But in terms of like your, it's kind of an obsession of yours, right? Because that, or not specifically, it's almost like the apocalypse is the means by which you talk about dissolution, which is your obsession, right? Like sort of collapse, like your collapse, your internal collapse, your problems, your struggles.
I call it the collapse, or you know, I like to talk to audiences like, well, the empire is crumbling. How is everybody doing in the crumbling empire? You know, the gig economy isn't that great. You know, you have PhDs riding people around on pedicabs out here. You know, molecular biologists. Sorry. But yeah, I like to talk about the fact that, and by the way, you know, I really don't want it to happen because once the pandemic hit, people were coming up to me going, you happy now? And I'm like, no, I am not happy. You know, I always think that I have had a sense of doom just because of the way I was brought up by my crazy Sicilian father, who, you know, Italians are very operatic. And he always just like it would be, you know, talk about drama, you know, melodrama, you know, it'd be like I'd be just hanging out as a kid and all of a sudden I would hear him bellow, "Who turned the thermostat up?" And I'd be like, oh, fuck. You know? And so I've always had this, like, sense of doom that I think I always am working out on stage. And now this is weird, but now my inner sense of doom is reflected externally in what I guess the whole world has been raised by my father, is what I'm thinking.
I'm interested as well about the, because when you mention your father, you talk about your father on the special, and I don't know how much of it is true. Right. I feel like the sense of it is true, but yeah. Maybe like, you know, when you're talking about him working on the docks, it's a great bit. I don't know if he actually worked on the docks.
Tell them
like,
about that bit.
Was it? It's such a good bit, guys. Eddie's father used to work on the docks. We don't even know where the docks are. That's
what I say. I say, my father used to work on the docks. This generation of people don't even know where the docks are. That's where the iPhones get delivered from. He used to just work on the docks, and he would unload these ships, and they didn't even know what the products were. They would just unload them, and they would beat each other with bags of oranges. Which is what they did back then. And he slept on the docks. He would just have live rats for warmth. And yes, that is not true. My dad was a high school teacher.
Yeah, okay.
See, you only know that. Nobody else but the people who took the time to come here. Yes. He was a high school teacher. But he had the mentality of like a dock worker.
Yeah.
He really did. I feel bad if there are some erudite, sensitive dock workers out there. But he really was just very primal. And then he would put on Mozart. He was just schizophrenic. You know. And he won't die. He won't die. He's 89, and it's a pain in my ass because I get the house and, you know, the little estate, and it would be great for me. I could relax. But he's like, I feel good. I'm like, fuck.
So, but it makes it like the, so there is, it's not factually true. He didn't work out the docks like this, but the starting point is true, or the kind of the.
It's emotional. I feel like I work from an emotional place.
Yeah.
You know, and not really a intellectual place, I think.
But it also makes sense for, like, Eddie Pepitone, the comedian, Eddie Pepitone, the persona, his father worked at the docks. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a really...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? There's this sort of thin line between you and the kind of heightened version of you, the kind of character... Like, it isn't a character, but it kind of is. And for the character's father to have worked at the docks makes a lot more sense.
Right. And, I really realized that the character that I have developed on stage, I'm kind of just doing my father in a way. You know what I mean? Like just this like melodramatic person, you know, where I'll turn on the audience and then I'll... Like one of the things I've learned recently is to be very up here like, you don't get me! And then be like, sorry, I yelled. Yeah. Like I love... Because that's, you know.
The mixed signals.
The mixed signal bit where I go, I had mixed signals growing up. And that's why I'm giving you mixed signals. I'm saying laugh and then I'm saying no. You know, because my dad used to be like, just tell me the truth. When I was a kid, just tell me the truth. Did you or did you not go to school? I'm not going to hit you. And I would be like, I felt like I was in Ocean's 11. I would be like, do I tell him the truth? And do I build honest relationships? I mean, he's a primary caregiver. So do I fucking tell him the truth and have a foundation for honest relationships in my life? Or do I lie and become one of these deceitful fucks who goes through their life just lying, but he gets what they want? So I told him the truth, and he hit me, and that's why I like rough sex. I confuse violence with love.
So I have a couple of observations on that. It's really interesting, because one is that like the, it's not scripted, right? When you were talking about the Doc stuff on the album is to do with him licking salt and drinking his own urine and stuff. Yeah. There's no bag of oranges in that bit. But like so each time you're kind of playing the game of that bit.
Yeah.
You know what the emotion is, and there's a variety of ways you can express that, and you can improvise it like differently each time, would you say?
Right, yeah, yeah.
There's like beats that you hit, but it's not the same sort of thing.
Yes. Instead of licking salt one show, it could be like he would just take the heads of mice and juice them and whatever. Juicing is incongruence there.
So this is my other question is, when you're improvising, does it then make it easier now that you have such a kind of a richly formed character of like the stage persona, is it easier to improvise from within that kind of like, you've almost like, the rules, you know, the parameters of what Eddie Pepitone.
Yes. And a matter of fact, like I was really tired when I arrived here on Friday, not to brag that I got here Friday. And I had a show and I was super tired and I came on and instead of being in my energetic character, I was like, hey everybody, oh God, I'm tired. And I lost them right away.
Yeah.
And then I came back. Then I lost them. And then I came back big. And then I lost them big. And then thankfully my time was up. And I said, this is the point in the set where you're supposed to get a big closer. But we both know that's not going to happen. And it didn't.
So that is to my earlier point, that's about like, you know what the rules are. So that's an example of you kind of like, you didn't inhabit the character in quite the way you normally would.
Right.
And so there was a flaw in it and it didn't go off in the way that it normally would.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Because when I'm really on and I'm really feeling like the audience is with me, I'm just going, I'm like, I kind of go into that character and I'm just, you know, I'm hitting on all cylinders, you know, right from the get-go when I really feel good at the top. A lot of times I'll have to work into it.
And what is that? I'm really fascinated by that. What's the head game that? What is you working into it? Is it obviously material choice?
Yeah.
You know, you could do something, your particular material you think would get
them. I really find that when I'm a little off, it's usually energy. Like, that's what I've come to, that my energy isn't great and I've got to summon it. You know what I mean? It's almost like a superpower. Like, let's use Thor. He needs his – is it Thor?
He's got a hammer.
He needs his hammer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I need my hammer, you know? And I need, and that's an energy thing. Like, I need my energy. I got to get into this fucking set, you know. But it is interesting because doing an hour, you know, a headlining set, it's difficult to keep, like, crazy energy for a fucking hour, which is why I have learned to modulate. But even in the modulation, like, I go up here and I'm like, you motherfuckers. You don't get me because you are civilians. You work in little cubicles with pictures of your family next to you. You're all one fucking coffee away from suicide. You know, you just have pictures of you. Oh, this is my last trip to Hawaii. You know, look at it. Look at how great my trip to Hawaii was. And you're just crying at your keyboard and you look up at you. But I have to take it down. Like, I have to, like, you know, find a way to keep the energy but still be and give myself a little bit of a breather from like really high energy.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, for sure. I think so what was I gonna ask? Something about your one of the other threads in the special is your neediness and like you kind of bullying yourself. Like I'm not saying
he's laughing because I'm needy on the road with him. I'm like, come on, we have to stop for coffee.
But you really
have to. Yeah.
You really kind of get into, like, you get into some really specifics about the neediless. Like, there's a few moments where you kind of come back to this idea that you owe people money and you feel ashamed of owing people money. Do you know what I mean? Or, like, that's the you know, fictional or not, that's the kind of process by
which... That's real.
Is that real?
But not people at this point, but institutions.
Yeah.
I owe money, and I hate them, and I'm like, fuck you. But then they fuck me.
But I'm interested in the expression of your neediness. Like, what's the relationship between you on stage as a kind of powerful comedian, having great shows, just like, you know, yeah, producing great material, and like, are you still needy?
Oh, I'm so needy, because I actually think that neediness drives me wanting to do stand up. You know what I mean? Because there's nothing like the high of, like, getting, you know, a crowd to, like, laugh, you know? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And they're fucking, and it's all because of you, and it's like, I'm up here in my head going, you did it again, you son of a... You know, that's part of me inside going, look at these fucking people. They fucking love you.
But that's,
that's such a great feeling, and it usually, I don't know how long it lasts, but not that long, you know, which is why I'm in therapy, because they hold out the carrot, you could just love yourself, you don't need external validation.
Yeah.
You know,
what do you think of that? What do you think of? Because I think that's, you know, often, I don't know if this is a cliche, if this is kind of a trope in the States, but there's certainly this idea in the UK that when comedians get therapy, they stop being funny.
That's bullshit.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
That's total bullshit. What comedians are saying that? Because that was a thing, like, oh yeah, if you fucking heal yourself, whoo, you can forget about having a good living and a good career. No, I think, you know, all that, you know, yeah, you have to go through stuff emotionally and painful stuff to, like, get to be a comic, I think, but at some point, you have to fucking, you know, heal emotionally, because, and that makes you a better comic, is my point, because then you're not wasting energy on, oh God, I suck, you know, that self-loathing shit that destroys us all, you know.
Let's talk about that. How self-loathing are you
still? I knew
still?
You would jump on that one.
You teed me right up.
I knew that perk you up. No, but what about self-loathing?
Well, what, like, how much is that an issue for you, or has it been over your...
Big, it's a big one, but it is getting better, and that's through, you know, so many fucking years of therapy, and just working on myself. But then there are days where, you know, out of the blue, it's like, oh, you piece of shit. You know what I mean? Like that voice, you fucking piece of shit. Imagine if I went on for like 10 minutes. Look at you. Look at you.
And what's the, like, what's the habit? What's the practice to get out of that? Like, after all the therapy, like, what have you...
I'll tell you what I do now, which is fucking... I listen to various things. Audible books. Listen to, like... I love Eckhart Tolle. Mm-hmm. I just like listening to that shit, whether or not I can practice it. But I love listening to Thich Nhat Hanh. I love... Like, all this, like... Like kind of Eastern philosophy. I love when philosophers are telling me I was never born and I'll never die. And I'm like, I'm home. My wife is yelling at me for something. I'm like, baby, I don't even exist. I'm just a field of consciousness. Leave me the fuck alone. And then she starts in and I'm like, ah, fuck. You know.
Is there a...
I listen to Rain now. Listen to Rain. I live in Los Angeles, which is a dust bowl. People in Los Angeles, it's like you're in a dust bowl with good bands. That line never gets a lot either. What? And it shouldn't.
And it shouldn't. Fucking jumped up audience member. Oh, my God. I'm asking you to reveal yourself.
Why not? Why not? You know, it just is kind of not that funny. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Oh. No, it's true. It's true. Now, you see, I earlier in my career, I would have been hurt by that. No, I'm not. No, I'm saying I'm not. I'm not. Oh, thank you for sticking up for me. Thank you. Oh, you thought it was funny. See? No, but I mean, now I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's fine.
Yeah.
Because I can tell he's a good guy, and he just, he knows what's funny. And he would like it known that he knows what's funny.
But that's it, isn't it? To deal with that stuff, if you are happy internally and don't need the affirmation, then you can stay playful enough to improvise a nice, confident response. And
yeah, because if you are self-loathing and somebody reflects back your self-loathing,
yeah,
and I've been through this, I want to attack that fucking person and be like, fuck you. Like, that used to be my big comeback line, was just, fuck you. And that's not witty or, you know. And people get nervous. You know, people are like, oh, fuck. They feel like they're at a fight at a dinner table. Oh, fuck.
Mommy. When you say it was your big comeback line, like, was it a successful comeback
line?
No. Was it, no, it was just something you would fall back on badly. Like, that was a mistake to
me. Yeah, like I think I said earlier, I would make the audience uncomfortable and I'd be angry. And once you're angry, that is not a place to do stand-up from. You have to have a playful anger, if that makes any sense. Or in my case, a playful rage. You know, like playful rage, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, go fuck yourself. This story, unfucking real, and it's, I just feel like this kind of shit happens to me, but I had to get up and make the earliest flight. Like, I had to get up at 4:30 a.m. To make a 6 o'clock flight to get to L.A. to film something, like a sitcom, and so I was going to make a bunch of money, and I had to be on this flight because I was filming the next day, and I get up out of my room in a Motel 6 in Fort Worth, and I get up, and as soon as I'm out of it. I'm like fucking out of it, you know? Those early flights are like, I'm just a fucking zombie, and I walk in, I open my door, and I walk in the hall, and within a second, a woman goes, they're not going to let you out of the hotel. And I'm like, what? And she's like, there's been a murder. And they're questioning everybody, and they're not letting anyone leave. Oh, and I immediately was like, I have a sitcom to film. They know what the fuck they're dealing with? And I got the fuck. I was like, I can't. I gotta go. You know, I had a. So I go out the door of the hotel in the back, and sure enough, there are police lights right on me. There's crime tape, and I feel like I'm in an episode of The Twilight, rolling my little roller, you know, my little fucking suitcase, you know, like fucking I look like Willie Loman. And trying to get to L.A. to film some shitty sitcom. And the police are like, sir. On a bullhorn, sir, you're gonna have to go back to the hotel. You're in a crime scene, and I ignored it, and you know, because I have to be. I'm an actor. People don't know in Fort Worth, the sitcom industry. So I just kept rolling the fucking, and for whatever reason, they didn't stop me, and I was able to go, and. This Uber, and the story isn't over. This Uber picks me up. He couldn't get close. He goes, what's going on? I go, there's been a murder. And I'm going to the airport, right? And within, like after about 5 minutes driving, the guy goes, You're just going to the airport, huh? He started to think I might be the killer. He goes, he starts asking me questions like, did they apprehend the suspect? And I go, I don't think so. I'm just being honest. I can't believe this motherfucker thinks he pulls, he fucking, you know, and he went into like a, he goes, I got to stop here, 7-Eleven. I want to look this thing up on the internet. I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me, you know? And I guess he finally found a website that said they had somebody,
okay,
you know, and I was able to get to LA. But yeah, that was it. So I stay in hotels and motels where people lose their lives so I can bring mirth.
Would you use that story on stage? Or is that not really in keeping with what
I
you
don't,
do?
I'm not a storyteller guy.
No, right.
And there are guys, and JT tells stories. There are guys who fucking tell great stories, and I don't know why. I don't have any. That's a story I have, but my other stories are just like, I vacuumed. Yeah. Like, I don't have big stories. Kind of makes me feel shit. I don't have, like, you know, I went to Hawaii and I just fucked everybody. You know, it's not happening. I went to Hawaii and I cried in a hotel room. Or whatever it was. I'm sorry.
And is that because you... Because the jumping off point, or not the jumping off point, but the way in which you jump off is always improvisation. So like that's where you're most comfortable. So that doesn't really lend itself to storytelling and truth. You're more interested in kind of like burrowing into pain in something improvised.
Yeah. But you know what I realized too is that I don't, that sometimes stories and like stories in my life, like they are a great source of material. And what that just reminded me of what you just said is that there are certain aspects of my life that I don't delve into. And one of them is when I waited tables in New York City for many years. I waited tables in New York for like 10, 15 years. And I was terrible. Like I was a bad waiter. And I would get fired. My line was, I have been fired from more restaurants than I've eaten in. And I would, like, come to the tables with, like, because I would always be eating. I was going to say backstage. I would always be eating, like, in the kitchen or something, like, sneaking. One place I worked was a French steakhouse, and they had something called profiteroles. Do you know what those are? They're delicious. They're puff pastries with ice cream and chocolate syrup. And I used to gobble down because I would be high a lot back then. And I'd gobble down profiteroles. And it was white shirt, and this was kind of a nice place. And I would have, like, chocolate sauce. And my manager would go, what the fuck? What the fuck? And I'd be like, I'm sorry, I had a profiterole. And they liked me because I was so, like, oh, my God. Eddie is funny, but he, God. And they would eventually have to fire me.
And you don't tend to talk about that stuff on stage. So like why?
No,
why
and
is
I feel
that?
Like waiting tables. I could do some more stuff about just how it's insane. It's an insane occupation. Everybody is high. If you've ever waited tables, everybody is drunk or high. Everybody is not a waiter, which is hilarious.
How do you mean?
Everybody here is usually in the arts who are waiting tables.
Like, yeah, okay,
I don't know about here. Probably here too, but like in New York, everybody was a dancer or fucking actor.
And were you a stand-up at the time?
I was doing stand-up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how long have you been doing stand-up now? Are you 60?
You don't ask a lady their age.
You said it on your special. But
no, I'm 63 now.
63, okay.
63. And I have been doing stand-up since... I started when I was 20, but I've had a circuitous route because of that, like, just incredible fear at the beginning.
Yeah.
I went into improv groups because I couldn't do it alone. Like, being a stand-up, I mean, is such a, you know, lonely thing at first. It's because, you know, like that whole thing of getting rejected when you're first starting out is so painful. And in my case, I had to, like, go into sketch. I did sketch groups. I did improv. You
kind
know.
Of as a way of putting off actually becoming a stand-up. Like, right. Knowing that you wanted to be funny.
Right.
But
right. And I was always the funniest individual. This is bragging, but I was always the funniest individual in the sketch group or the improv thing. But, you know, and I always wanted to be – I'd always be like, I need to be alone. These people – fuck these people. You know what I mean? And so I eventually found my way back to stand-up.
Yeah.
After – and I took a lot of acting – real serious acting stuff in New York, and I knew I was going to be a comedian because I'd be doing shit like Death of a Salesman, and people would be cracking up at like maybe trying to be serious. You know?
And you genuinely like not you weren't kind of finding comedy in it deliberately. You were trying to be serious,
right?
They were finding it funny. Just talk about that. What is that? What's going on
for
there?
Me because that sucked. Because there's a part of me that wants to be a real serious. Like I don't know if every comic has this, but like there's a part of me that would love to just make people cry constantly. You know,
yeah.
Like a real great dramatic act. Actor,
it's interesting, like the real great dramatic actors, was it like a secondary thought after wanting to make people cry? Do you know what I mean? In the same way that as a comic you make people laugh, you kind of make people do a thing against their will, and maybe there's a relationship with that and you're kind of your sense of power or something.
I find that the great actors though all can do comedy really fucking well, like Alec Guinness, Gil Good. I'm doing this for you, they're Brits.
Thanks, mate.
De Niro is a funny guy. I mean, Midnight Run, he's just a funny lunatic, you know? I find that really good dramatic actors are really fucking funny. Tony Shalhoub, Brad Pitt. I threw him in for the ladies.
What was it like working with Rachel Bloom?
Yeah, that's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She is a sweetheart. She really is a total sweetheart. And really like you know, when you go on someone's show, they're usually like, hey, welcome and stuff. And, you know, sometimes you feel like they mean it. Sometimes you don't. But Rachel really made me feel very at home, and she's a very giving performer. And I don't know, just really a doll, you know? Yeah.
Thank you. Down here. Oh, we've got it. We have a mic.
Yes. Oh, cool. I don't want to get too technical, but as a comedian in your career, have you developed such beautiful eyes?
Not as easy as it looks. Most people will say genetics. You had nothing to do with it. I originally had brown. But through great internal work, you know, the eyes are the window to the soul. So as you do, no.
That was a great question.
I get
Thank
that.
You.
I get that a lot. You have great eyes.
Do you get that a lot?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My eyes, forget it. I'm a hit on Instagram.
If you could prevent the end of the world from happening, would you?
Would I?
Great question.
If it was completely in your hands.
Of course. Yeah, but there would have to be, in my view, like capitalism, and we're in the end stages of it. We're in the very end stages of it. We can't do capitalism anymore. We can't have, you know, fuck it. Right now there's like 45 billionaires who have most of the wealth on the fucking planet. That has to end. It has to be redistributed, and you know, the cities have to be torn down. Unfortunately, that includes Austin here. No, there's got to be a big makeover on everything. But yeah, of course I would prevent it, unless we were all infected with radiation, and you know, if we were all fucked up just like like brunch was horrible at this point. You know what I mean? Like brunch was just a wailing and gnashing of teeth, you know, with a couple of jazz musicians.
Could you just on that, just on the apocalypse. Thank you for your question, sir. On the apocalypse, do you have, like, how much optimism do you have? Not like stage persona, Eddie, but like you. Are you just entirely pessimistic about the state of the world? Do you find hope anywhere?
I am at this, you know, and maybe it's because of the Russian invasion of the Ukraine that happened recently, but I was like, oh, fuck. This is real. This is horrible, you know? And I don't know, man. I'm a little pessimistic, you know? Who wouldn't be coming from a pandemic? I'm a big, like, lover of animals and nature. I've tried to be vegan for 9 years, which I have my slips, but, like, the fucking ecosystem, I think, is shot. I mean, anybody who reads knows, you know, that these... This is a great way to end the show. knows that the glaciers are melting and the Arctic is melting and superstorms are... Good night! <Yeah.
laughs> Do we, whenever things like this come up, is there anyone in this room, and we are at South by Southwest, is there anyone out there who has cause for optimism that they could share with us? Yes! Get a microphone to this person.
Well, I guess the only thing I would say is that if you look in history, people have been pessimistic for a long time.
I understand that, they never had this eco... collapse.
Yeah, but it was always something. It was always something.
Yeah, but previous civilizations...
It was Spanish flu, bubonic plague. I mean, they literally thought everything was ending.
Where? When?
Bubonic plague, Spanish flu.
Spanish flu. Yeah.
Like, you know, there were things that literally took out, like, a fourth of the planet. That happened. That happened.
Yeah.
But, like, you know,
I would have done well, by the way, back then.
Right.
That would have been my type.
You would have been
of...
very popular, even more so than now, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for that note of optimism.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
No, he's still going.
Oh, sorry. Well, you're still going. If there's more optimism, we'll hear more.
No,
we'll hear more.
I hear you. The only thing...
I think that's all the crowd wants in terms of optimism.
No, the only thing I would disagree with is even the plague, which took out a quarter of the world's population, what they didn't have was a planetary ecosystem collapsing. And that's what we have. And... You know, I don't think it's reversible at this point, you know? And that's why you have the billionaires making plans to go to fucking Mars or wherever, you know?
Any further cause for optimism? Anyone else?
By the way, as far as that space travel, I can't wait till there's blue-collar crime on spacecraft. Like just muggings and shit on one of Musk's rocket ships.
Any further questions? One at the back there.
So I don't know if it's optimistic, but I have a quick question about, you know, you mentioned a very specific number of 45 billionaires. You know, what about, what do you think we should do with those 45 billionaires in the next five years?
I think that we should execute...
Just for an exciting idea.
Yeah, I think we should execute them on pay-per-view. Like, you have to... I really mean it. You know, yeah, I think pay-per-view is the way to go with those guys. Just execute them. Like, let's say, like, for instance, my idea for Bezos' death would be, this is kind of like the Orient Express, if you've seen that. Like, each Amazon worker gets a knife. And they all get one jab into Mr. B.
I'm going to have to put a spoiler warning for the Orient Express now on the front of the show.
That was 50 years ago. What? Or more.
Thank you. There's one in the back over there.
Yeah, so you talked about the need for a lot of comedians to be comedians. Do you wish that you didn't have that need?
Do I wish that I didn't have it?
Like, you know, if you
were
like,
free of the need.
Right, exactly.
Do I wish that, yeah, of course. I mean, if I'm talking about it, you know, someone who just wants to be healthy, do you wish you didn't have the need for external validation? Yeah, but if I didn't have that need, I never would have been a comedian, you know? I never would have found this life, you know, this rich and varied life here at South by Southwest. And so, when I walk the streets, occasionally somebody will go, hey. And I'll be like.
So would you rather be happy or funny?
I want to be both.
That's not an option.
What? That's not an option?
It's not available.
To me, there's no happy without funny. I mean, all we have really, and this is to combat the end of the world too, which is why I have a podcast called Apocalypse Soon, which, you know, I'm trying to make light of all this shit. Yeah. Like, you know, we only have our sense of humor to deal with the all of this shit. We take life way too seriously. So if you didn't have sense of humor, you couldn't be happy, right? You have to have a deep cosmic sense of humor. And by cosmic, I mean a lot of acid.
I have some Australian coworkers that say they don't have Australian comedians because they are too happy, and so they don't have a source for material. So do you feel like really the true root of comedy is in existential dread and collapse?
I do think it is. In Australia, it's too nice and stuff.
I mean, one in the eye there.
By death over there with all those fucking things that live on that continent. It's like, oh, it's a rockfish! Or whatever the fuck.
Stonefish.
The rockfish or the dingo stole the... The dingo took the baby!
Is that an Australian accent?
Terrible Australian accent. Of a dingo!
I won in the eye there, that question, for the hundreds of comedians working in Australia.
I know. I know. There's great Australian comics. Ooh, you know them.
Oh,
all.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Barker.
He's from the States. Like Jim Jefferies and Ronnie Cheng.
Is Jim Jefferies from Australia?
Yeah.
He's hilarious.
Yeah. So we can think of one. this is episode 398, I believe. There are at least 60, there's got to be 60, 75 Australian comics.
Wow.
On the show alone. And I haven't done them all yet. And if I can before the apocalypse, I will. Thanks. The recording may not have picked that up. A smattering of applause, one woo, and then the wooer said, good luck.
So that was Eddie. Thank you so much to him for coming on the show. Thanks to South by South by for South by South by. I've just invented a new festival. What did someone? God, he was funny. Someone called it he was doing a character which was kind of like, I guess, a sort of luxury redneck. And he kept referring to it as the 5x5W Festival. Very, very funny. I should find out who he was. Was it Haley something? Anyway, I'll get back to you on that, possibly. Thank you to everyone there for looking after us. Thank you to Nathan Wood for uploading the show. Thanks to Jake Crossland for the logging. Peter Dobbing is your podcast consultant and Blue Sky Thinking aficionado. And as ever, this podcast exists in its entirety as a means of leveraging joy and optimism into the life of Brett Goldstein. Thank you to all involved. If you're part of Retweet Squad, then follow this at ComComPod, and the pinned post will always have the latest episode on it. So if you've enjoyed this one, hi ye Christ on a bike, I wish I were dead. Hi, who even says that? I'm just morphing. That's even worse than Partridge. Hi ye Christ, I'm embarrassed. God, hi, what is that? That's hi ye in the sense of go to. That is that's like Esther Ranson, just that's life. Hi ye Christ, I'm so glad I don't have a radio show, because there would just be nowhere to hide. I'm going to leave this in as a punishment to myself. But go to, I don't even remember where I was suggesting you go to, but wherever you go, go there. The show's on at Monkey Barrel, 4th to the 11th of August. Check out Eddie's special For the Masses, released by 800 Pound Gorilla, and blow me tight, they do some good gear, so look out for everything they're doing, because, whoa, I have it on good authority, they've got some roastingly good content coming up soon. And enjoy your lives. That's it, no post-amble this week. Boutros has got chicken pox, which is probably why I sound mad. Love to you from him. I was going to, not from him. Yeah, he probably would. He's a loving guy. He'd probably send his love. And I was going to tell you sort of week by week about some interesting things that had happened at South By, but I will save them probably for 2 weeks from now, because next week is the big birthday special, and it will be an episode like and like none other. Like other? Like other, brackets and none. I mean, it's an episode, but it's a particularly good one, and it's wonderful. It's with Rob Deering, and he was our guest 10 years ago on episode one. So look forward to that next time. Thank you. That's it. Goodbye. Back to the pox.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.